We are in Exodus chapters 14 and 15 today. Exodus chapters 14 and 15. A familiar story within these passages. Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Tell the sons of Israel to turn back and camp before Pihahiroth, between Migdol and the sea. You shall camp in front of Baal Zephon, just opposite it, by the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the sons of Israel, 'They are wandering aimlessly in the land. The wilderness has shut them in.' Thus I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will chase after them. And I will be honored through Pharaoh and all his army, and the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord." And they did so. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, Pharaoh and his servants had a change of heart toward the people, and they said, "What is this we have done, that we have let Israel go from serving us?" So he made his chariot ready and took his people with him, and he took 600 select chariots and all the other chariots of Egypt with officers over all of them. The Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he chased after the sons of Israel as the sons of Israel going out boldly. Then the Egyptians chased after them with all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army, and they overtook them, camping by the sea beside Pihahiroth in front of Baal Zephon. As Pharaoh drew near, the sons of Israel looked, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they became very frightened. So the sons of Israel cried out to the Lord. Then they said to Moses, "Is it because there were no graves in Egypt that you have sent us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us in this way, bringing us out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we spoke to you in Egypt, saying, 'Leave us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians'? For it would have been better for us to have served the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness." But Moses said to the people, "Do not fear. Stand by and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you have seen today, you will never see again forever. The Lord will fight for you while you keep silent." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Why are you crying out to me? Tell the sons of Israel to go forward. As for you, lift up your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, and the sons of Israel shall go through the midst of the sea on dry land. As for me, behold, I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they will go in after them, and I will be honored through Pharaoh and all his army, through his chariots and his horsemen. Then the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord, when I am honored through Pharaoh, through his chariots and his horsemen." The angel of God, who had been going before the camp of Israel, moved and went behind them, and the pillar of cloud moved before them and stood behind them. So it came between the camp of Egypt and the camp of Israel, and there was the cloud along with the darkness, yet it gave light at night. Thus the one did not come near the other all night. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord swept the sea back by a strong east wind all night and turned the sea into dry land. So the waters were divided. The sons of Israel went through the midst of the sea on the dry land, and the waters were like a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. Then the Egyptians took up pursuit, and all Pharaoh's horses and his chariots and his horsemen went in after them into the midst of the sea. At the morning watch, the Lord looked down on the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and cloud and brought the army of Egyptians into confusion. He caused the chariot wheels to swerve, and he made them drive with difficulty. So the Egyptians said, "Let us flee from Israel, for the Lord is fighting for them against the Egyptians." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea so that the waters may come back over the Egyptians, over their chariots and their horsemen." So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its normal state at daybreak, while the Egyptians were fleeing right into it. Then the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. The waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen. Even Pharaoh's entire army that had gone into the sea after them, not even one of them remained. But the sons of Israel walked on dry land through the midst of the sea, and the waters were like a wall to them on their right and on their left. Thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. When Israel saw the great power which the Lord had used against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and his servant Moses. Then Moses and the sons of Israel sang this song to the Lord and said, "I will sing to the Lord, for he is highly exalted. The horse and his rider he has hurled into the sea. The Lord is my strength and my song, and he has become my salvation. This is my God, and I will praise him. My father's God, and I will extol him. The Lord is a warrior. The Lord is his name. Pharaoh's chariots and his army he has cast into the sea, and the choicest of his officers are drowned in the Red Sea. The deeps cover them. They went in, down into the depths like a stone. Your right hand, O Lord, is majestic in power. Your right hand, O Lord, shatters the enemy. and in the greatness of your excellence you overthrow those who rise up against you. You send forth your burning anger, and it consumes them as chaff. At the blast of your nostrils, the waters were piled up. The flowing water stood up like a heap. The deeps were congealed in the heart of the sea. The enemy said, I will pursue, I will overtake, I will divide the spoil. My desire shall be gratified again. They sank. My sword and my hand will destroy them. You blew with your wind, the sea covered them. They sank like lead in the mighty waters. Who is like you among the gods, O Lord? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in praises, working wonders? You stretched out your right hand, the earth swallowed them. In your loving kindness, you have led the people whom you have redeemed. In your strength, you have guided them to your holy habitation. The peoples have heard, they tremble. Anguish has gripped the inhabitants of Philistia. And the chiefs of Edom were dismayed. The leaders of Moab, trembling, grips them. All the inhabitants of Canaan have melted away. Terror and dread fall upon them. By the greatness of your arm, they are as motionless as stone. Until your people pass over, O Lord, until the people pass over whom you have purchased, you will bring them and plant them in the mountain of your inheritance, the place, O Lord, which you have made for your dwelling, the sanctuary, O Lord, which your hands have established. The Lord shall reign forever and ever. For the horses of Pharaoh with his chariots and his horsemen went into the sea, and the Lord brought back the waters of the sea on them, but the sons of Israel walked on the dry land through the midst of the sea. Miriam, the prophetess, Aaron's sister, took the timbrel in her hand, and all the women went out after her with timbrels and with dancing. Miriam answered them, "Sing to the Lord, for he is highly exalted. The horse and his rider he has hurled into the sea." Then Moses led Israel from the Red Sea, and they went out into the wilderness of Shur. And they went 3 days into the wilderness and found no water. When they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore it was named Marah. So the people grumbled at Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" Then he cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree, and he threw it into the waters, and the waters became sweet. There he made for them a statute and regulation, and there he tested them. And he said, "If you will give earnest heed to the voice of the Lord your God, and do what is right in his sight, and give ear to his commandments, and keep all his statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you, which I have put on the Egyptians, for I, the Lord, am your healer." Then they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water, and 70 date palms, and they camped there beside the waters. The word of the Lord. So I'm sure I'm not alone in the fact that water has been on my mind quite a bit over the last few weeks. 4 weeks ago today, I stood before you somewhat flustered because I'd woken up to a flood in our kitchen, and we learned later that a rat had gotten into our house and eaten through one of our new PEX water lines. That was only the first of 5 separate leaks that we had in the house over the course of our break, the most recent of which was just Friday. And each time we've had to shut down the water and go without water until the plumber could come back out, and we've had to call ServPro, and they've come in and had to rip out sheetrock and all that sort of thing. So we've experienced both an excess and a deprivation of water over the last few weeks. And then last week, I spent a couple of days down on the Gulf Coast staring out at the ocean, and I was reflecting on the simultaneous beauty and the frightening power of the sea. The same water that we enjoy as vacationers becomes terrifying in the event of a storm. Under U.S. common law, this is something I'm familiar with, our approach to dealing with stormwater, the sort of legal doctrine, is called the common enemy doctrine. It entitles property owners to fight that enemy as they see fit and direct the water off of their property. When a flood occurs and waters rise, consuming entire communities, man's limitations become obvious. The same is true of drought, which is no less devastating in its consequences. Now, I'll grant you that man's engineering powers have improved over the centuries. Ancient man learned how to irrigate, to transport waters over long distances, as you can see in the Roman aqueduct system. Then modern man has developed impressive dams and dikes and levees to mitigate flooding and create huge reserves of water. But still today, man has no ultimate control over the water. If you've seen the photographs of Lake Mead and some of the reservoirs out west, all of our engineering prowess is just humbled as we see that we're at the whim of those water sources. We still suffer devastating floods and droughts. So in the face of major water events, man is helpless God, however, is not. The prophet Jeremiah wrote, "When he utters his voice, there is a tumult of waters in the heavens, and he causes the clouds to ascend from the end of the earth." Jeremiah 51:16. Well, in the midst of my reflections on water in my basement and in the sea, I've also been studying this passage of Exodus, in which the Hebrews first experienced water as a frightening obstacle, then as a source of deliverance, and then they suffered its lack. In each instance, God used water to demonstrate both his power and his favor on the Israelite people. So chapter 14, I realize that I've mislabeled this. If that confused anyone, I apologize. But chapter 14 begins with God telling Moses where to lead the people as they left Egypt. And again, we don't know where these places are. We have these place names, but we don't really know exactly where they were. So any designations on our maps involve some speculation. But we do know that that path involved a reversal of course. God told them to turn back from the direction that they were headed. And that their final destination was somewhere on the sea. And we also know that God had purpose, both in that change of direction and in positioning them on the sea. God told Moses to change direction to create the false impression among the Egyptians, particularly Pharaoh, that the Israelites were in a state of fear and confusion. He said they've gone into the wilderness, they've gotten frightened, they've turned around, they're vulnerable. God was luring Pharaoh and his army of chariots into a fight. The location on the sea was intended to impress upon the Israelites God's power. He was placing them in a situation where they had no alternative other than to rely on God. Through all of this, both God's own people and the Egyptians would know that he was God. Now, we've read about a couple of changes of heart in Pharaoh. So, of course, Pharaoh was initially hardened toward the Israelite people. He wouldn't let them go despite repeated pleas, despite all the plagues that came upon him. He wouldn't change his mind, wouldn't change his heart. And then finally, in response to the final plague, in which Pharaoh himself lost his firstborn son, God caused all the Egyptian people to be favorably disposed toward the Israelites. They gave the Israelites all their stuff, their jewelry and their precious metals. Pharaoh himself let the people go. Well, in verse 5, God lifts that spell, and there's another change of heart. We read that Pharaoh and his servants had a change of heart toward the people, and they said, "What is this we have done, that we have let Israel go from serving us?" Because the Egyptians had not just lost all the wealth that they'd given the Israelites as they went out. They'd also lost their labor force that had been doing all this work for them, and they came to the awareness of how much they'd lost. So they had a change of heart. And this also indicates that the Egyptians who'd sent the Israelites out, who'd given them these things, they hadn't experienced a true repentance. The only thing they'd experienced was a reaction to those relentless plagues. And we talked last year about the fact that oftentimes when people suffer certain hardship, they might profess belief, they might have a temporary change in direction, but oftentimes it's not really a change in heart, it's not a change in faith, but just a reaction to the stimulus of pain. And that was true of the Egyptians here. They let the Hebrews go because they wanted to stop the pain of the plagues, but they didn't really believe in the supremacy of God, Yahweh. They were still arrogant. They still would not came with their entire hearts were hardened, and they pursued the Israelites again. And they came with their entire army of chariots, including 600 select chariots, the Bible tells us, and all the other chariots of Egypt. Chariots were a mark of wealth and military supremacy. They provided mobility and attacking speed. They were really the weapon that Egypt had used to rule that part of the world for centuries, and now those fearsome weapons were directed at God's untrained, unarmed, and vulnerable people who were camped by the sea. Well, the Hebrews saw the Egyptian army bearing down on them, and they were afraid, understandably so. They had an attacking army at their backs. They had the sea at their front. And most of your Bibles identify this as the Red Sea. But most of your Bibles also include a note indicating that the literal translation of Hebrew is the Reed Sea, or the Sea of Reeds. So there's some disagreement among scholars as to which body of water this was. It was probably either the Mediterranean or the Red Sea. But in either case, it was an utterly uncrossable body of water. It was as effective as a wall. From the moment the Hebrews first saw the Egyptian chariots, keep in mind, if you're on the sea, think of how quickly a chariot would move, would really only be a matter of minutes before the chariots were on them. But it seemed like there's a longer period of time that happens here. But their situation was impossible. Imagine being a father with your wife, with your children, with your few possessions, there camped by the sea. You see the chariots approaching. You turn, you look at the sea. There's no option. It would seem in the moment that there's no hope. In verse 10 of chapter 14, the Hebrews did exactly what they needed to do in response to the situation. They cried out to the Lord. But in the following verses, we see that this wasn't so much a cry of faith, it was a cry of fear. Now, when I was younger, I found this story perplexing. I read the Hebrews' fear in this moment as an indictment of their character. The Hebrews had just enjoyed this extraordinary supernatural deliverance. They'd witnessed all the plagues of Egypt. They'd experienced themselves the fulfillment of this 400-year-old promise. Pharaoh had actually let them go. They'd experienced all these extraordinary things. And then when they encountered the next obstacle, they cried out in fear. Why didn't they simply believe and expect deliverance? But now that I've experienced a few tight moments with armies behind and seas ahead, I get that fear. I better understand it. Most of us are aware of the story of the parting of the sea as long as we can remember. I mean, I don't remember a time when I wasn't familiar with the story. It was probably one of the first stories that many of us learned. But put yourself in the Hebrews' shoes. They'd never heard this story. They were living this story. They saw an approaching army behind, an impenetrable sea in front. Their situation was humanly impossible. So they were afraid. And in their fear, they despaired, saying, "Is it because there were no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us in this way, bringing us out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we spoke to you in Egypt, saying, 'Leave us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians, for it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness.'" Now, the Israelites claim to have said those things to Moses back in Egypt, but there's no record of their having done so here in Exodus. It's possible that they did, but it's not recorded here. But in the end, whether they'd actually said these things, made these requests to Moses back in Egypt, is not relevant. What's relevant was the state of their hearts there at the sea. They at least thought they'd said it. They were so afraid of death that they lamented ever having been delivered in the first place. They had already started to rehabilitate their memory of what it had been like back in Egypt. And in that rehabilitated memory, Egypt was a place of safety and stability, even if it was also a place of misery and oppression. This was not the last time that the Hebrews would respond to a new challenge by expressing the wish that they'd never left Egypt in the first place. Men, beware of this human tendency. So sometimes after making a good change in our lives as a step of faith or an act of repentance, a lot of you guys have probably made some resolutions as we start the new year, some changes in direction, hopefully those involve some spiritual commitments. And so often, though, after we make those good changes, we face some challenges. And then in our fear and our frustration, we begin to tell ourselves that we're better off before. We were wealthier, healthier, happier. But insofar as our life change was an act of faithful obedience, we were never better off before. As Paul wrote in Romans 6, we are enslaved to either sin or to Christ. And sometimes the very challenges we suffer after a step of faith are part of that process of shaking off the shackles of enslavement to the world. It's not to say that the challenges aren't real and painful and frightening, only that the process of sanctification produces a life that is more pleasing to God and therefore better in every way than a life before sanctification. It is only when we count the things of the world as having greater value than the things of heaven that the before of the Christian life is ever better than the after. But despite their fear and their lack of faith, their very imperfect cry to God, God honored their cry. He heard the people. He did not forsake them. Among his great gifts to the people was their leader Moses, who in this moment did believe. Moses did expect deliverance, and he said to the people, "Do not fear. Stand by and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you have seen today, you will never see them again forever. The Lord will fight for you while you keep silent. The Lord will fight for you while you keep silent. What a great promise. Many times I've claimed this promise when I faced challenges and truly did not know what to do. I didn't know the way out. I have faced situations that seemed impossible, unsolvable, unending. And I've used Exodus 14:14 as a prayer, a comfort, and an instruction. The Lord will fight for you. Depending on your translation, our role in this is to be still, to be silent, or to remain calm. But in every version, it's to a new crisis who does the fighting. For most people, their response to a new crisis is to say, oh no. There are, however, a select few who encounter a new crisis and say, oh boy. Moses was among the rare ones. He saw this as an opportunity to witness the majestic power of God to deliver. He said to the people, in essence, stop freaking out, stand still, and have a look at what God is about to do, because it will be amazing, and it will be a source of faith and encouragement for the rest of your lives. God then said to Moses, in my words, time to stop the talking. It's time for a miracle. Send the people forward because I'm about to do an amazing thing. Moses, raise your staff over the sea and I will divide it, and the people are going to walk through the sea on dry land. So again, we're familiar with the story. We're so familiar with it that it doesn't sound terribly odd to us. Well, of course, God parts the sea and you walk through. That's what you do. I've been to Universal Studios. I've been on the ride. I know how that works. But they'd never heard of or seen anything like this. No one had. But this was all part of God's plan. Not only were the sea and the Egyptians non-threats to God's people, the sea and the Egyptians were props for God to demonstrate his magnificent power. In verse 18, God said, the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I am honored through Pharaoh, through his chariots and his horsemen. Do you see what God has done here? What he's flipped? This great threat, this overwhelming force, the seemingly insurmountable thing. God says, that's going to honor me because I'm going to show you that I can overcome it. Well, the next verses in Exodus describe an awesome scene as this pillar of cloud and fire that had gone before the people now moves behind them to get between them and the army of chariots that are invading. And this explains that delay of time. So as the chariots are approaching, that pillar that had been guiding them in the right direction comes, the angel of God, it says, comes behind them and is literally fighting for them against the Egyptians, delaying their advance as the sea parts and the people can walk through. Modern scholars have sought to explain away the supernatural elements of this episode, and they say, well, this wasn't really a sea at all. I mean, the Hebrew says it's a sea of reeds. It was this kind of reedy marsh, and the chariots just went in there, and they got bogged down because they were heavier, and the people were able to walk through on foot, and once they got bogged down, the Hebrews turned around and slaughtered them, and that's really what happened here. But that's not what the text says. The text describes a body of water so large that the separation of the waters created significant walls on either side of the dry land. The Hebrew term used for wall here connotes a very large wall, like a city wall. Not a small stone wall, not a retaining wall, but a massively large wall towering above the Israelites who marched on dry land with the walls of water on either side of them. Well, as the Hebrews moved slowly on foot between the walls of water, God threw the Egyptians into confusion. Their chariots malfunctioned. They were giving inconsistent orders. Even as they said, let's flee, they ended up driving toward. Ultimately, all the chariots ended up between those same walls of water. Once God's people were safely through, God instructed Moses to raise his staff again, and those massive walls of water closed on the Egyptian soldiers. As the Israelites witnessed this and the waves washed dead Egyptian soldiers onto the shore, the Hebrews had a new sort of fear, a fear of God. They believed in their God and they believed in Moses, who was God's appointed leader. Chapter 15, the next chapter, is probably the oldest passage in the book of Exodus because it's a song that the Hebrews sung in the aftermath of this great victory. It's likely that Moses wrote most of the Pentateuch, which is the first five books of the Bible, later when the people were encamped at Mount Sinai, but the people sang the song recorded in Exodus 15 immediately after their delivery through the sea. And someone can imagine groups of Israelites singing the song on their way to Mount Sinai and then in the wilderness wanderings after, teaching each new generation through this song, through music, the story about their deliverance from the Red Sea and the Egyptians. And so important was this song to all generations that this song is described in Revelation as a song that we'll be singing in heaven. It's in Revelation 15:3. It's a victory hymn. It's one that ascribes all credit for the victory to God. It begins and ends with the phrase, "The Lord is highly exalted. The horse and his rider he has cast into the sea." So for those of you who've grown up in the faith and spent lots of times in church, there's a lot of segments of this song that are probably familiar to you, kind of some synapses fire. You might remember a song or a teaching. In verse 2, Moses writes, "The Lord is my strength and my song." This communicates that human strength is inadequate for the challenges of life, that human aspirations are an insufficient anchor for our joy. The Lord is our strength. The Lord is our song. In verse 3, we read, "The Lord Yahweh is a warrior. The Lord Yahweh is his name." And that asserts God's willingness for God to fight for his people against their foes. We see in this that God is more than a soft, benevolent entity who always dispenses mercy and never justice. He is a warrior and he fights for his people. For people who are offended by these facts about God, they're wishing for a reality that never existed. God does get mad. He does smash his foes, and he is majestic in doing so. And sometimes when I read these passages, I ask myself the very basic question, whose side do I want to be on in the decisions of life? Verses 13 and 17 speak of the great hope of people believing, the great hope of believing people both then and today, which is that God will ultimately bring his people to where he is. Verse 13, "In your loving kindness, you have led the people whom you have redeemed. In your strength, you have guided them to your holy habitation." In verse 17, "You will bring them and plant them in the mountain of your inheritance, the place, O Lord, which you have made for your dwelling, the sanctuary, O Lord, which your hands have established." So in this is an acknowledgement that this victory at the Red Sea, as great, as magnificent, as memorable as it is, was not an ultimate victory. That people were still looking forward to that final day, just as we are looking forward to that final day, when we will be where God is. It takes discipline to maintain that hope. We're easily lured into other hopes, like material prosperity, physical comfort, worldly praise. But none of those are ultimate hopes. All of those hopes will disappoint. Our great and enduring hope is that one day God will bring us to where he is. At the end of this section of chapter 15, we read that Miriam taught the women to sing this song so as to preserve the memory for the nation of Israel. And we see here again the importance of remembering, not just as individuals, but as a community, this community remembrance. We need to remember together as a community of people who share in the experience of God's grace. Well, then, after experiencing this magnificent miracle of the parting of the Red Sea, the destruction of the Egyptian army, singing this magnificent song of praise, Moses led the Israelites away from the sea and into the wilderness, and they had no water for 3 days. It's easy to take water for granted. I mean, normally we can turn on a spigot and get all the water that we need. In recent weeks, I've grown an appreciation for that simple pleasure of having running water. I mean, when your water's off, I can't tell you how many times I've gone to the spigot to like brush my teeth, and I turn it on. Oh, drag! There's no water. And you go to flush your toilet, and like I already flushed it the one time I was able to flush it. So I have to go to my neighbors and turn on their spigot and fill a Home Depot bucket. That's been my life for the last 3 weeks. I suspect that a lot of you have suffered something similar with all the frozen pipes and burst pipes that we had over Christmas Eve. You can't shower, you can't wash dishes, you can't do laundry, you can't flush toilets. I'm questioning how much detail to give you about this, but as we're sitting around opening our Christmas gifts with all of our family and with the house guests, we're about, kind of halfway through the process, and my son says, "Dad, do you think the gas station's open?" And so we all loaded up and drove over there to go to the bathroom. It was a charming Christmas tradition I'd rather not repeat. But then imagine being in a wilderness with your family for 3 days with no water at all and nowhere to get it. At least I could go to my neighbors after their pipes were no longer burst and fill up some 5-gallon buckets. But ancient Israelites had no such options. And they didn't need water merely to clean. They needed water to live, to survive. The closest I've come to that experience is in backpacking, and sometimes I've been on a dry trail, and you go for miles and miles and miles, and all the springs are dry. There's, you know, you just don't see any sources of water, and your water source is getting lower and lower. There's a sort of panic that sets in. You're like, am I going to find any water? And you start to get thirstier and thirstier. So there's that low-grade panic. But I never went for even a whole day without any water. And the Hebrews had gone for 3. So when they finally came to the waters at Marah, the water was undrinkable. So just imagine that, just being completely parched, you're completely out of water, you're reaching desperation, you see or smell the water ahead, your animals smell the water, and everyone rushes up only to find that the water is undrinkable. It will actually harm you if you try to drink it. Only to learn that this was a false hope. So again, even after experiencing a series of extraordinary miracles, the people didn't hope here. They grumbled again. They feared again. But again, God had mercy on them, and he made the water sweet. It was here at Marah that God gave the people an ordinance. If you will give earnest heed to the voice of the Lord your God and do what is right in his sight and give ear to his commandments and keep all his statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you which I have put on the Egyptians, for I, the Lord, am your healer. So this was not a promise that the Israelites would never suffer any diseases. Some people have claimed that promise. Some people have interpreted it that way, and in doing so have developed an unhealthy theology that all illness that we encounter is due to our sin. But rather, this was a promise that if the people gave heed to the voice of God, he wouldn't visit the plagues of Egypt on them. Well, from Marah, God led the people to Elim. And in Elim, they camped next to fresh springs in the shelter of trees with no threat of pursuit from the Egyptian army, because there was no Egyptian army anymore. God had destroyed it. And this sounds lovely and peaceful, but the camp at Elim was only a brief respite before the next journey and the next challenge. Elim was not their destination. The Hebrews weren't home yet, and they still had much ground still to cover. So let this be a reminder to us that moving from challenge to challenge is not unusual in the Christian walk. We shouldn't expect to constantly be camped out in Elim. Sometimes it's like that, and God gives us those moments of respite where we can heal and breathe and sort of restore. But he's going to have us move on again, and there will be new challenges to come. Those challenges are not unusual. We should expect them. They are ordinary for the believer. My nugget this morning: if you are facing the impossible, remember that you serve a God who loves you and who conquers the impossible. As we begin a new year, some of you may be saying, oh boy. Others of you may be saying, oh no. For many of us, 2022 was challenging financially and professionally, and at least in my world, there's some storm clouds on the horizon for the first quarter of 2023. Many of you struggle with difficult family dynamics, and the holidays serve to highlight that. Some of you may have expiring contracts, approaching deadlines, or just a whole lot of uncertainty. For the past month or so, I've had a whole series of oh no moments, including but not limited to the partial and potentially uninsured destruction of my home from flood. I know that many of you feel the pressure of challenges behind and obstacles ahead, so it's possible that some of you are feeling hopeless because your situation seems impossible. If you are suffering an oh no season, then I encourage you to remember the times that God has delivered you in the past. Remember the character of God, that he is a warrior, that he is majestic in power, and that he is your savior. Just as water is simultaneously something we need for sustenance and something that could present a great threat, challenges can either take us to despair or to a more robust and resilient faith. In response to a challenge, you should certainly do everything within that's within your sphere of responsibility. This is not an encouragement toward passivity. But if you have done all that you are responsible for doing, then you need only be still, because it is God who is fighting for you. If your situation seems impossible, impossible may be the point. Maybe God is seeking to show you once again who he is and what he can do. And with that, we can go to the tables.